These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 10th, 2018. We thought it might actually be spring here in Northeast Ohio, and we were wrong. Lots of snow, wind, and ice this past week, so it's a good time to snuggle down with a podcast. We're off to Richmond, California this week to speak with one of the behind-the-scenes heroes of bicycles and a man probably every frame builder across the world knows, Mark Norstad of Paragon Machine Works. From its inception in 1983 when Mark started manufacturing parts in his parents' basement to the 8,000-square-foot building his business occupies now, Paragon Machine Works has provided frame builders the finest parts, including bottom brackets, lugs, dropouts, tubing, and more. Mark, who was inducted into the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame last year, also has a broad and deep involvement in advocacy. We're going to have a long conversation with Mark in a few moments. Then after our break, we're going to head to Connecticut to speak with Colleen Kelly Alexander. Colleen's story is both terrifying and inspiring. It begins with her father's bike shop in Arizona when she was little, moves to Florida for her high school years, and then she goes out on her own. Coming from a very conservative background, she made her way after leaving a marriage she knew was wrong and put herself through college. A series of health problems, including a diagnosis of lupus and the need for brain surgery, were ultimately resolved, and she was finally on her way, married to her childhood sweetheart, planning for a family of their own, working for an organization she loved. Then, on her daily bicycle commute back from the office after a great meeting on a clear and bright October afternoon, the unthinkable happened. A large freight truck ran a stop sign and ran over Colleen. First with his front wheels, and then with his rear. Colleen's book, Gratitude in Motion, is the riveting account of her life and her determination to get well and honor the everyday heroes around her. I love the book. I couldn't put it down. And you'll hear Colleen's conversation in the second half of our show. So here we go, off to Richmond, California, for a chat with Mark Norstad from Paragon Machine Works. Hi, Mark. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for hosting me. I appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. You know, I've talked to dozens and dozens of frame builders, and I'm really interested in speaking with you because you're the guy who really makes the frame builders work. You make a lot of their frame building parts. I know my husband uses parts from you. Let's start at the beginning. Talk a little bit about 1983 when you were in your parents' basement and started Paragon Machine.
Okay. Well, I was backing up a little bit before 1983. I had visited one of my old bosses after I was going back to school, And he suggested that I start a machine shop, and the thought never had occurred to me. But I took his inspiration and went out and bought a couple of machines, a lathe and a mill. And I did set them up in my parents' basement, and I spent a day out hunting for work. And at the time, Marin County is sort of the, depending on who you talk to, the birth of or the inspiration of the mountain bike. And I was into riding bicycles. I was into machines. And when I was out hunting for work, one of my stops was at the Cove Bike Shop in Tiburon, and they were involved in making trail mass bicycles. And one of the first jobs I ended up with then was making front dropouts for a Trailmaster fork. And then there was a bunch of other work I did as well. But the intention of the machine shop in 1983 was simply going to be a job shop where we would take on any work that comes in the door. And fortunately, I was in the right place and I was of the right frame of mind. It was bicycles that bicycles were a part of it right from the beginning.
Interesting. So before we move on to something else, I want to ask you a question that never occurred to me based on what you just said. I know you have a degree, but do you think that there is more need today for people who go and do machining, for example, to be employees of yours or to start something like you, as opposed to having to take a 4-year degree?
Well, let me try to understand the question. Is it better to just go out and get to work, or are you saying that it may possibly be better to have a four-year degree before you get to work on that stuff?
Well, no, I think what I'm really saying is, do you think the opportunity to get somebody into a program where they'll come out as a machinist as opposed to a doctor or a lawyer or something else is just as important? And maybe we head high school students away from 4-year bachelor's degrees and into vocational type programs.
Right. Well, I would, you know, I'm kind of biased there, but I'd say absolutely. I think there is a real need for manufacturing, and there's a real need for people who have these skills. And it's a perfectly good career. I mean, there's a whole lot of skilled trades that are being downplayed because of the push that every kid should be going to college. And it's pretty clear not every kid needs to be in college, and a lot of kids are probably better off doing some sort of a skilled trade rather than going to college.
Perfect. Well, I just wanted to clarify that because that's sort of been my thinking. And, you know, I don't have a 4-year degree. I have, you know, a couple years of college here and there. But, you know, I think I've done okay in the bike world.
Well, right. Yeah. And I'm in the same boat. I've had, a 2-year degree in machine metal technology and then another couple of years of college just goofing around on my own, which helped me a lot. But, it was not a formal 4-year degree in a fancy college.
Right. So let's go back to Paragon Machine Works. So as a machine shop, I know you do a lot for the bicycle business and it is probably your main line of business. I think that's correct. What else do you offer though?
Well, we still are a job shop. We still offer any kind of general machine work as long as it sort of fits within the capabilities we have and the machine we have and the talents of the people we've got here. So some of our other customers, we've got a customer who makes winemaking equipment. So that's a lot of sort of stainless steel parts. We've got another customer that makes locking fasteners. And for a long time, we did a part for them that ended up with Caterpillar. Until his patent ran out and Caterpillar went elsewhere. But all sorts of oddball fasteners, nuts and bolts that have specific mechanisms for this guy's patented locking device. We've got another customer that makes submersible pumps that specifically go into landfills for recovering the methane that is in landfills.
Very interesting. You started in your basement and then you had to move out of there because you already got busy, right? Where did you go first? I know that you're in a really comparatively big building now.
Yeah. So the first move out was to a 1,000-square-foot shop, which I shared with one of the guys who was doing Trailmaster bikes, Eric Koski. Fairly soon after that, Eric sort of stopped showing up and was a little casual about paying his rent. So I asked him to leave, and then I took over the entire 1,000 square feet. I was there for quite a while, probably 10 years, I guess. And then after that, the next move was two doors down. There was a 2,700-square-foot shop that became available, and I jumped on that. And I was really only in there for about 5 years when the opportunity came to purchase the building we're in now. And it's a much bigger space. It's about 8,000 square feet, but it's across the bay from where I was before in Marin County. And if you're familiar with the Bay Area, real estate prices are out of sight around here. So we were able to buy this building for what we were paying in rent in Marin County now that we're on the other side of the bridge in the cheap area.
Wow. It's nice being your own landlord.
It sure is. It's great.
Right. And that way, if something goes wrong, you have nobody to blame but Mark, right?
Right, exactly.
Let me take a moment and remind our listeners. We're speaking with Mark Norstad. He is the founder of and grand poobah at Paragon Machine Works. And if you don't know what the company does, if you have a custom-made frame of any sort, my guess is there's probably a Paragon Machine Works part on it somewhere. So I want to talk a little bit about the economic collapse of 2008, because something happened there that worked out for you, I think.
Well, yeah. So in 2008, when the economic disaster or downturn or whatever you want to call it occurred, all of our job shop stuff just dried up. It just disappeared because all of those companies were hit by the downturn as well. And what got us through was the bicycle components. And my theory there is if you have enough money to buy a custom hand-built bike, it doesn't matter what the economy is doing. You probably still have the money. But that's not exactly true because there are a lot of people who are absolute bike enthusiasts who scrimp and save every penny, and their custom hand-built bike is their pride and joy. And it takes the place of their car or other financial considerations.
But I would agree with you for the most part that in some ways you were insulated from the economic issues because the customers like a Richard Sachs or like a Mark Noblet, those kind of guys, are using your parts and of course, Don Walker didn't hurt us by putting the North American Handmade Bike Show together. So it's sort of like that was it's sort of an insular little industry.
Oh, yeah, it is. Absolutely. Yeah. And actually, sort of going back to your thought about the North American Handmade Bike Show, the sort of rate at which the hand-built phenomena has been growing is really amazing to me. At one point, I had one or two employees and me, and we kind of fiddled around and made some bike stuff, and now we've got 10 full-time people doing it. So it really has grown phenomenally.
Are you seeing a lot of new builders coming online, or are you seeing existing builders queues getting longer?
Both of those. The existing builders are building more, it seems, and there are certainly new builders coming up all the time. I sort of compare myself to the gold rush days. Rather than if the frame builders are gold miners, I'm the shop owner who sells the picks and shovels to them. Yeah, there are new guys coming up all the time. You can see the new tables at NABS. One of the things that I think I hope we've been able to do to encourage people is not have any kind of restrictions on who is able to buy our stuff. I mean, there are some frame building suppliers who want you to be a certified frame builder. I'm not sure how they judge that, but we are happy to sell to anyone who's got some money. So that lets all the hobbyist builders buy our stuff and put stuff together. And if they like it, they can take their hobby to a second level and try to do it professionally.
Yeah, you know what? I think that's a really interesting point, that there are some people, and if we just move this into the retail scene for a moment, as opposed to a builder, if you don't have a storefront, we're not going to sell you parts.
Right.
There are some distributors and manufacturers like that. And yet, to get somebody, it's sort of that chicken or egg thing, to get him big enough to be a Richard Sachs or somebody like him, you need to build a few frames and you need to get these parts to make them work.
Right. Yeah. And everybody has to start somewhere. And that's usually at step one.
Exactly. So I want to talk a little bit about your designs and the innovations and how the actual need for your parts has changed and the parts themselves have changed. So dropouts used to look a certain way. Dropouts don't look anything like they used to look in some regards. You have these sliders and you have disc tabs and all this stuff going mm-hmm. on. And you have a lot of categories listed on your website.
Right.
Where are you seeing most of the innovation and how are you keeping up with that and how do you come up with your designs?
Well, the innovation is being driven by, sort of the component manufacturers, which is, and consumer demand. But the big changes are 12 millimeter and 15 millimeter through axles, disc brake stuff. That really has impacted what we're doing. The electronic shifting stuff, not so much. It just means that our cable stop sales have dropped, but we're not making any new parts for electronic shifting bikes. But that's really been where most of the growth has been. And our designs are driven sort of by there's this mechanical component where you have an axle that's a certain size, and a hub that's a certain width and a brake that's got to be mounted in a correct relationship to the hub and the wheel. So those are these fixed points that we can't say anything about. That's our design is driven by that. And our challenge is to sort of connect those dots and make something that is, you know, one, it's got to be functional. And two, it really has to look nice. If someone's spending thousands of dollars on a custom frame, they want something that at least looks decent. So the cosmetic part of it is a big component of our design thought and our design philosophy.
So your finishes are really fine.
Yeah, and we really do make an effort to make those really nice, in particular on stainless steel and titanium, because very often those materials don't get painted. So that raw material kind of shows up, and it's on an expensive bike, it's got to look good.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned the word titanium, and I did want to talk about titanium because you do offer titanium tubing. And while we were building a lot of sevens, everybody would ask, and it's so interesting what the customer asks about these bikes, you know, which titanium do you use?
Right.
Well, you have to ask the manufacturer. So I'm asking you, what is the titanium tubing that you offer, and why do you offer that?
Well, we are offering domestically produced 3-2.5 titanium. 3-2.5 titanium is really the only practical titanium for building a bicycle frame. And it's, well, not necessarily for building a bicycle frame. It's very difficult to have tubes made from 6-4 titanium. It has been done, but they're so ridiculously expensive. There's not a whole lot of advantage to that. And the big thing I'm talking about here is seamless tubing. Seam tubing can be economically made from 6-4, but that's kind of a different story. A frame built out of 3-2.5 titanium isn't going to break any sooner than a frame made out of 6-4 titanium. And the 3-2.5 titanium is, it was not developed for bicycles at all. Originally, it was used for hydraulic systems in aircraft because it is light and it is strong. And the first commercially successful titanium frames were all made from 3-2.5 titanium, which were leftover aerospace stuff. And that goes back to Merlin bicycles in Boston.
So how are titanium tubing sales right now?
Our titanium tubing sales are not very good because we are sourcing domestic material and competing with material coming from offshore, both China and Russia. So I can sort of tell who's using offshore titanium by who we're not selling material to. It's kind of odd.
Right, of course.
You know, but there are definitely some builders in the United States who really make the effort to go out and buy domestically produced titanium. And it's gotten down to the point where there are only two mills that are making 3-2.5 titanium. And the lead times are typically, you know, a year or more. So the business model of building titanium frames is a really difficult thing to predict where you're going to be in a year or what tubes you're going to need that far out. But there are definitely some builders who are doing it. And then there are a lot of other builders who are sourcing offshore material, which is much less expensive. Lead times are a lot less. And the quality of the material ranges from just as good as domestic material to quite a bit less good.
And how does one tell? Or is that's one of those who knows, right?
That's kind
you
of,
probably
kind of
can
who knows.
Tell.
I mean, even offshore material comes to you with certification, so it will tell you what the strength of the material is, what the chemistry of the material is. But I think it's one of those things, unless the frame builder is willing to conduct some independent tests, it's sort of, buyer beware situation.
Yeah, it's a crapshoot,
yeah.
Basically.
That's an honest way to put it.
Well, you know, that's it. It's just true.
Yeah.
You know, that was always an issue for us. If you would buy something from Italy and they said, oh, we guarantee it for life. Well, you may or may not see a replacement ever if it breaks. You know, so you have to weigh your odds in that. So we're going to take a break in a moment here, but I'd like to know two more things. Mm-hmm. And that is, what do you think has changed in the bicycle industry the most in the past 5 years, as far as your work is concerned?
Probably two things. One is embracing newer standards for all the different components that have come along. And two is having to adapt our designs that are necessarily made from steel or titanium to designs that were originally meant for aluminum or carbon fiber.
Give me an example of one of those designs.
Well, let's see. An example would be, say, on a fork, an inch and an eighth steel steer on a fork would never ever, in cases of extreme abuse, it would break or fail. But really, a straight inch and an eighth steer made of steel is essentially bomb-proof. But when you make that same steer out of aluminum, it really is not strong enough. And it's the same situation in carbon fiber. So what they've done is come up with fork steers that are inch and a half in the bottom, tapered up to inch and an eighth. And in aluminum and carbon fiber, your weight penalty really doesn't matter going up to something that big. And actually, you get a much stiffer, stronger structure when you go to that larger diameter. So our sort of goal, and then, of course, this larger steer tube has to fit into a larger head tube. Okay, so now when you make a head tube out of titanium that starts out at being 2 1/4 inches in diameter, and you're trying to match the dimensions of a carbon fiber head tube, there's just really no way of getting away from the weight penalty that titanium one, even though the titanium is a very light for a metal, is going to weigh a ton compared to that carbon fiber component. So what we're trying to do is make our designs from titanium and steel as light as we possibly can, and of course still be structurally sound, but we just can't compete against carbon fiber as far as weight goes.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question, how much carbon fiber has impacted everything you do.
It's a difficult thing to say. I mean, our sales are at the very least steady or growing in general. So if carbon fiber wasn't around, I would imagine, you know, those sales would have been higher. The guys who are building custom bikes, who really are our customers, rarely build from carbon fiber. I mean, there are getting to be more of them out there who are custom building from carbon fiber. But generally, they build from aluminum, steel, or titanium, which is really what we do. And on the high-end bike kind of scope, if a customer wants to buy a high-end steel bike, at this point, there's really no option except maybe a custom builder, because all of the major manufacturers just are not doing high-end steel at all in any way.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to finish our conversation with Mark Norstad and talk about his induction into the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back, and if you are just joining us, you need to rewind your system and listen to the first half of my conversation with Mark Norstad. He is the founder of and grand poobah, as I said, of Paragon Machine Works out in Richmond, California. I want to talk about your induction into the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, because obviously you're not a mountain biker. You do not build mountain bikes. There is a category for people like you, and tell us how that all came about. And it was just last year. So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's very much a personal milestone for me. But the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame has got different categories for journalism, for riders, and for industry. And that's the category I fit into. And my induction into the Hall of Fame is for what I've done in the industry, manufacturing frame components for small builders who are then able to compete with some of the other manufacturers, and also to manufacture some innovative stuff that these guys either would not have access to or they couldn't afford otherwise. So basically, my role in the bike industry has been able to give builders in this particular case, mountain bikes, stuff that would be difficult for them to get otherwise.
Well, and again, congratulations. I think it's awesome.
Okay,
it's really important. I want to move away from what you do in your shop to what you do in your community, because you are incredibly involved and have a lot of advocacy components to that part of your work. So what are some of the programs that you're involved in, and why did you choose the ones you have?
We've mostly chosen local bicycle advocacy groups. So the bicycle coalitions of San Francisco, the East Bay, Marin County, Sonoma County, and some local, I'm trying to think of all of them, Friends of China Camp, Friends of Tamarancho, which are places where we can ride locally. So there's sort of, one is supporting our local organizations. And that's kind of, I guess, maybe a little bit selfish. We could probably branch out and do some national stuff. But one of the big things is, if people don't have a place to ride, why are they going to bother buying our components or a bike with our stuff on it? And that's really sort of, it's a business decision almost, that people need a place to ride. And one of the things that I feel that has enabled bicycles to grow so much is the fact that there's so much more infrastructure now where people can take their bikes, whether it's on a trail or a bike path or just a stripe on a road that gives a bicycle a place to go. If you have a place to ride and you feel safe there, you've got a good motivation to go out and buy a bike. And eventually, we hope those guys can buy something, some of our stuff.
While it sounds self-serving on the one hand, I have seen that it's important that you're still there, because, you know, it's like the loss of bike shops. If we lose all the bike shops, there's no service, there's no community.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, and the bike shops certainly are a big part of that sort of thing. If people have a place to ride, it's not going to do them any good if they don't have a place they can work on their bike. So, yeah, I'm all for the local bike shop as well.
What do you see, and you have a different perspective than a lot of people, what do you see as the biggest failing of the bike industry, if you can just like take a broad view, even though you are involved in a very small niche?
Yeah. This is painting with a really broad brush, maybe. And maybe ruffling some feathers. But I think one of the things that the highest and best purpose for a bicycle, personally, I think, is transportation. And second to that would be recreation. And third is competition. And when you look at how bicycles are promoted, very often the competition comes first. The Tour de France obviously is a big deal. It's on TV. There's a lot of sponsorship dollars, things like the Red Bull sponsorship for extreme bike riding, stuff like that. So I think one of the things that the industry promotes or shows bicycles as being something that is very exclusive to people who are very athletically capable, when really anyone can ride a bike, and it has so many more advantages than competition. And if you look at a bicycle as a transportation tool, everything about it is good. It's good for your health. It's good for the environment. The impact on everything is less with a bicycle. I mean, there's just so much about it. So the sort of failing of the industry is not really promoting the bicycle for what I feel is its best use.
Couldn't agree with you more. I think that's really, I think that really sums it up pretty well. Those 3 points, and if they would just reverse them,
yep,
and refocus their efforts, they might see a whole different result from what they're seeing right now.
Yeah.
So what would you do to make cycling safer? Because I think a lot of the fear is being on the road with your bicycle. Now, of course, trails and paths don't count, but I mean, for people who want to use the bike for transportation or recreation, getting point A to point B or whatever.
Well, one of the things is, any one cyclist, can't change the world. But I would say if you want to feel safer or be safer, join your local advocacy group and notice what the conditions are around locally and let your local group know what's going on. The other part about that, I'd say, is be really defensive. If you ride at dusk or dawn or anywhere where the light is bad, make sure you have good headlights, good taillights. And the thing that really is amazing, there's so little reflective gear out there. Get reflective gear. It is so good at night. You really get lit up. Good helmets, good gloves, protective stuff. But sort of there's no way to systematically make everything safer without, talking about infrastructure projects and a lot of money and that kind of stuff. So the quick fix for any bicyclist is be on the defensive and be alert and dress for what you're doing.
Really good advice. I would agree with that too. So are you working on any special projects right now that you can talk about?
Not particularly. I can talk about any of them. What we're working on is this more 12 millimeter stuff, more flat mount brake stuff, more capability to add disc brakes onto 12 millimeter dropouts, just in a general category. We've got customers literally all over the world who want to update their product line from 10 millimeter dropouts to 12 millimeter and disc brakes. So that's happening as well.
Yeah, disc brakes has sort of changed your business a little bit.
They really have, disc brakes. There's some components that have revolutionized bicycles, and disc brakes are one of them. Index shifting is another one. For off-road, suspension is another one. You know, and these are all and clipless pedals is another one. These are all components that when they first came along, people kind of said, who needs it?
You know,
and for disc brakes, with the original disc brakes, they don't work well. They're heavy. They cost a lot of money. Well, that's all changed. The weight is really, really reasonable. They work fantastically, and the price is not bad at all. So these innovations that sort of represent stepping stones that people aren't going to go backwards. People aren't going to give up their disc brakes and go back to rim brakes. People aren't going to give up their clipless pedals and go back to toe clips because they are so much better and they work so well that there's just no reason to ever go back. And I keep wondering what is going to be the next sort of innovation like this that people are going to say, I'm never going back again. And it's out there on the horizon. I'm just not sure what it is yet.
Yeah, do you have any inkling?
No, I don't. You know,
me neither.
I think the electronic shifting has not matured all the way. I think it's still kind of in its infancy. I think we'll see a lot of improvement there.
Yeah, it'll probably trickle down too, price wise.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There are internally geared hubs and internally geared transmissions, specifically like the roll off hub or Alpine 11 speed. There's the pinion transmission that mounts in the frame. So there's a possibility some of these geared systems may take over from traditional derailleurs. They are still, you know, much, much heavier than a traditional derailleur. I'm not sure there's any way around that. But I think in a lot of applications where things are extremely dirty, you know, these systems could really pay off.
There is one category that very few people address at all, and one that I have a specific interest in because I'm a stoker, and that's the tandem category. I would love to see some more components for tandem.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where, unfortunately, the market for tandems is very small. So, unfortunately, that's going to be the last place you see that kind of innovation happening. But there's tons of room for improvement on tandems, that's for sure.
Yeah. What do you do when you're not working?
I do my best to ride my bicycle as much as possible, recreationally, not competition. So the bicycle, we got two kids in high school, so our hands are full keeping track of them. Both of them are athletes, so we go to their athletic competitions, and that's a lot of fun. I just try and relax and enjoy myself.
That's a good thing. So I have three questions I always ask my guests, and I'm going to ask them to you before we wrap this up. And I really appreciate you taking so much time to talk with me today.
My pleasure.
What's your favorite food?
I'm going to say anything that my wife makes, but specifically her pizza.
Wow. Homemade pizza.
Yeah.
How nice is that?
Yeah, really great.
And what music do you guys listen to?
Classical.
Excellent. And do you have any pets?
Three cats.
All right. Man, you just have those answers right off the top of your head. That's pretty cool. Well, Mark, thank you so much. You'll be at NABS in Sacramento, I take
it? We certainly will.
Well, we will probably see you out there. I appreciate you taking so much time to talk with me. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you, Diana. It's my pleasure.
All right. You have a great day.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Mark Norstad joined me from Paragon Machine Works in California. What an interesting guy. What a great story. I really enjoyed speaking with him. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back to speak with Colleen Kelly Alexander about her new book, Gratitude in Motion. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back, and it's off to Connecticut to speak with Colleen Kelly Alexander. Hi, Colleen. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure. I have spoken with many athletes, men and women, and I don't think I've ever heard a story quite like yours.
I'm glad.
Well, yes and no, but yes, to some extent, yes. And to some extent, no. It's a pretty inspiring story in a lot of ways. And so I'm not even really sure where to begin. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about you as a teenager, which is sort of where the book starts.
So as a teenager, I lived in Daytona Beach, Florida. And we went to high school at Seabreeze High, which was home of the Fighting Sand Crabs, which is a brunt of many jokes.
Wait. The Fighting Sand Crabs? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, the Fighting Sand Crabs were the claw rolls. Bizarre.
Okay, that is bizarre. Yeah. By the way, that is not in the book, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, move on.
Yeah, I grew up very close, right down the street from the ocean, and had a fascination for the ocean and getting out on my bike, going backwards in time a little bit more, a lot more. When I was little, my dad owned a bike shop. So it was right around when they had me up and walking on two legs steadily, he started getting me on a bicycle. And I took right to it. I absolutely loved riding. My dad rode a little more competitively and was an avid cyclist most of my childhood. And so when he owned the cycling store out in Arizona, I would go in to work with him all the time. And so one of my things that I love to do is to go in the back of the mechanic shop and sit up on the benches and watch the mechanics work. And I was just fascinated with all things bicycle related. So that was always a huge love of mine. And when we moved to Florida, I then became excited about the ocean and I wanted to explore the ocean. So we had a garage full of bikes and I started riding as many of them as I could fit as I grew into them and just exploring the coastline. And that became sort of my child, adolescent love, if you will. I was raised pretty conservative Southern Baptist, so I was involved very heavily with my church, and met Sean when I was a sophomore in high school, and he is now my husband, but we dated for about 7 months, and it was just as sweet and innocent as it probably could be. I knew that my path, if you will, was really, or the way that it was supposed to go per girls that were in my church, and was that you get married and you have babies and you're a stay-at-home mommy. And so I decided that it was important for me to put myself in college. As a Christian woman, it wasn't necessarily a priority for me to be educated because the belief was more that education leads towards secularization. So if I were to have wanted to go to college to maybe be a school teacher or maybe a nurse, it wouldn't have been so bad. Those weren't really the things that I was interested in. So after my marriage ended, which was in my very early 20s, with this other person who I had never been in love with, but just knew that was my next, that's where I was supposed to go in my journey. I started putting myself through college and went to the University of Vermont to study psychology and world religion and started down my new path.
Let's take a moment and remind our listeners we're speaking with Colleen Kelly Alexander. She wrote a book called Gratitude in Motion. It is one of the most gripping stories I have read in a long time. It's one of those you can't put it down. So you actually married a second time, and he was more of a free spirit, and I thought that that was kind of an interesting relationship. Although, you know, in the back of your head, you think, where's Sean? Like, where is he and what is he doing? But that'll come up in a little bit. So tell us a little bit about the work you started doing with these kids in Vermont, because it was a really interesting sort of path that you went down that led to where we're going to go eventually here.
Yeah, so I knew that I wanted to go back to school and I wanted to study psychology. I wanted to understand the world that I knew was much bigger than the way that I was raised. And I met Dave, who was my former husband, there, and an incredible human being, so much zest for life, Jewish, did not believe really in a God at all, beyond attractive, and I just fell head over heels. And so we married for quite some time, and unfortunately, I developed lupus. I have a Chiari malformation, so I had brain surgery, and he just really wasn't able to handle that. And so I think we all have our strengths, and for him, that wasn't one of them as a caregiver. So he fell out of love, and our marriage dissolved, which was very sad, and that's where Sean pops back in. So my work with the youth center had started shortly after 9/11. I had been working in the corporate sector in human resources, and the day that 9/11 happened, I remember sitting at my computer, and everything was just going on as normal. Like, people were calling about having loans, and you know, they were talking about the different, you know, with the IRAs, the rates were, and I thought, this is insane. So many people just died. There's this horrible attack, and we're just supposed to keep working. And it was a really pivotal moment in my life, which I know it was for most all of us. And I decided on that day that I needed to do something different. I resigned my work shortly thereafter 9/11 and realized that I needed to have a greater understanding of humankind and be more connected in my work. And so Dave and I were still together at that time, and he suggested that maybe I look into doing AmeriCorps. And it was the best choice that I've ever made. And so I applied with AmeriCorps. I found a placement at this youth center up in northern Vermont, and my shoots grew, I guess you could say. I really felt like for the first time, my tree, I always think of myself as kind of this tree, was getting nourished, and I was rooted, and I knew that what I was doing was what I was supposed to be doing. So I continued that work for about a decade through our marriage and the end of our marriage, and had found my purpose, if you will, I think, in this life, which was to be a vessel of love and not of judgment, which was, you know, I don't want to say that the Christian faith is completely full of judgment, but there's a good chunk. I guess that's true of any faith. As one who was Southern Baptist, I was raised to believe very strongly that certain lifestyles are wrong and sinful. And working with the youth, I was confronted with a lot of the things that I thought growing up were not okay and that were bad, i.e. kids coming out that they were homosexual or that they were bi. And I always worried how I would experience that if it were to happen. And it happened just like anything else. It was this these moments of gratitude, of just feeling so thankful that kids were comfortable to even come up and share with me, and that they could feel safe in this space. So throughout my journey, you know, of just transition and change, I had this really cool ability to continue to grow spiritually. Yeah, my work at the youth center was powerful and some of the most important years of my life, I think. Sean and I reconnected after my former Dave and I separated and then divorced, and Sean found me online, and it was, my fear was that it was going to be like an eat, pray, love kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
Because I saw pictures of him and I thought, holy crap, this guy's gorgeous. He's an adult now and he's huge and he's got big, giant chest muscles and he's just this big, beautiful guy. And so I immediately got a little nervous. Thank God he was living in Colorado, so he was distant from me. But after a couple of months, we started talking and we just connected in a really cool, beautiful way. And it brought us back to dating again. And, you know, we have those roots together.
So once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Colleen Kelly Alexander. She wrote a book called Gratitude in Motion. And we're going to come to a part of the story where not only cycling comes in, but cycling becomes sort of a focus in not a very nice way. So you were, all this while, you were doing things with cycling because you created a ride. I think you changed jobs, moved to Connecticut. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yep.
You created a ride that was like 600 miles and you raised a bunch of money. And I mean, you did some really cool things, always with these youth groups as part of the vision.
Yeah. Cycling for me has always been an outlet. When you're a cyclist, it's part of your DNA, I believe firmly.
Yes, we believe that there's a cycling gene.
Right. I mean, cycling for me was never a hobby. From the time I was walking, I was on a bike, and it's just literally kind of become like an appendage to me. It's a part of who I am. And so when I lived in Vermont still, before we moved to Connecticut, we actually had a cycling rental business and rental fleet, and I would do cycling tours, and it would be nothing to go out and do 100 miles every weekend for no other reason than just because I could. Like, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't racing. It was just, it was meditative. It was therapy. It was life. When we moved here and Sean and I started building our home together, I was working for an international nonprofit, and my job was a program manager for marketing and education. And I knew that we needed some assistance with funding and also with PR. And we didn't have a lot of funds for budget. So our territory was all of New England and New York. And so I asked my director if I could take some of my vacation time and get on my bike. And instead of, so basically I needed to visit all these sites, but that costs mileage. You know, that's time that I'm being pulled out of my job, lodging, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's all those expenses involved. And when you're a nonprofit, those things are pretty slim. So, hey, why don't I take some vacation time? And I also visit all these places, but I do it on my bike. I mapped out a 600-mile route starting in Connecticut and then going through Rhode Island and Massachusetts and New York and Maine and Vermont, you know, all through New England and New York, and then ending up in Portland, Maine. And the goal was that we would do about 100 miles a day in those 6 days. And then at night, we'd stop in the communities, we would set up talks, we would meet with some of these programs and these kids that were doing the programs to find out what they're doing and then highlight them in the media. And at the same time, I would ask for sponsorship that would then go towards funding for Peace Jam. So I would be raising money as I was cycling and not spending any money. You know, the only thing I was spending was calories, which was pretty cool, and occasionally some tubes, which was fine because bike shops are always awesome, and they find out what you're doing, and they're more than happy to, these guys were always more than happy to service my bike if needed, depending what state I was in. Yeah, and it was great. We raised several thousands of dollars, you know, connected with thousands of people, and did it all basically for free. And I didn't even have a flat on this trip.
You know what? That is, therein lies the problem. You just jinxed it. Because you know now, yeah, now you're going to have a whole series of flats. You know what? We're going to take a real short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back, and we are speaking with Colleen Kelly Alexander. She has written a book called Gratitude in Motion. And from what I understand, she is one of the most gracious people in the world. And she probably doesn't have a lot of reason to be gracious. We're going to pick up the story where we left off. And that was, she was raising a lot of funds for the work she was doing with Peace Jam, a nonprofit, worldwide nonprofit, I think. Pick it up from there.
Sure. So we had a great ride. We went through all 6 states, all 600 miles. Raised a lot of great money, made a lot of connections, spoke to a lot of youth doing wonderful work, and not even a flat tire. So got home, and I was called into a meeting on a Saturday from my supervisor, who just, you know, wanted a basically a rundown. How did it go? And, you know, kind of just an updated report and to let me know how things were going as well with the organization, because it was just about a year that I had been hired in Connecticut. I cycled into work. That's normally what I did. It was 12 miles each way, and it was fall, and it was a positively gorgeous day, and fall is always my favorite time of the year, and I biked in, had a meeting, great meeting. I actually put a Facebook post before I left work that day stating, I wonder how many more days we're going to get away with these rides. Like, it's just so gorgeous, and how grateful I was to be able to commute into work. I got halfway home, and a truck came down a side street and started to stop at the stop sign and then rolled right through it, a big freight truck. And so I was clad in my bright neon yellow Pearl Gleamy top and my Livestrong bright yellow helmet, and I had my yellow panniers and my blinky lights and you name it. And unfortunately, this time it didn't matter. So the guy rolled the stop sign, and the truck was massive tons. And, you know, there's no time for anything. So I was on a straightaway, and he blew the stop sign. So he rolled me over, front and back sets of tires, dragged me, ripped me apart. And I stayed alert. I had been an EMT years prior. So I think between being a psych major and an EMT, I weirdly triaged myself. I knew that my chances of survival were pretty slim. If this wasn't my last few breaths on earth, that I needed to do whatever and fight like hell to stay awake and alert, because I'd been, literally ripped apart. So the double tires, if you were to think about a big freight truck's double tires on the human body, I was run over just below my sternum, all the way down past my knees. So thank God it missed my sternum, because my heart would have been crushed and then there would have been no going back. But I was literally gutted and ripped apart. And the trauma surgeon said it was almost like those old school apple peelers where you put the apple on it and you crank it. And that's essentially what those tire grooves did to my skin, just ripping apart my abdomen, butt, legs, and then my iliac crest got completely severed off and just, broke ankles and whatnot. So we had been actively trying to have our firstborn. Unfortunately, one of the things with the ending of my last marriage, after going through all the medical issues and poor Dave struggling, just dealing with a wife that had brain surgery and lupus and everything else, I really wanted a baby, and he just super didn't want a baby. And so Sean was very excited about us starting a family, and we were finally at that, I'm late for my period time, and my womb was just trashed, completely ripped apart. So I got backboarded and hauled off pretty quickly by a crew of all women paramedics, and flatlined within like a minute and a half of getting to the trauma bay. So my femoral had also been ripped on my left side. So I just bled out and was resuscitated after about 20 minutes, and then bled out again. And it, as quickly as they could try to get a heartbeat back, which the first time was over 20 minutes, but then after that I just had multiple cardiac arrests because they just couldn't keep blood in my system. So once they got me somewhat stabilized, I was in a coma for about 5.5 weeks and in and out of surgeries. I talk a lot about the horror of that in the book, and being in a coma is pretty terrifying, but thank God I'm on the other side. And then I was at a rehab hospital for quite some time, a couple months, and then I came home. And thank God this husband can handle gore and discomfort. It's been an interesting journey. And as soon as I could start to be active again, mentally, I wanted to start organizing a bike tour, because I knew the rehab hospital that I was at had an adaptive sports program, and I knew the power of cycling and of exercise. And I met all these people at the rehab facility when I was inpatient that were stroke patients, or they had, some sort of massive head injury, or they were amputees or whatever it might be. And, you get someone on a bike, even if it's a leaning back bike where they're using one arm or they're using one leg or whatever it is, and they get that cadence and they can start feeling that rhythmic motion, there is this eternal connection to the bliss of childhood to some extent. And it's really cool to see. And so I asked if I knew that for the next couple of years I'd be in surgeries off and on, if I could help organize a fundraiser, like a bike tour fundraiser for the program. And that way I would be able to get out of my own depression and anger and be able to start focusing on something a little bit bigger, and not knowing if I'd actually be able to participate in the event, which we organized it for pretty much a year post-trauma for me. But I knew how to organize bike events. I knew how to, I'm a cyclist. I knew the ins and outs of what it takes to do something like that. And I knew the gratitude that it would bring for me and to other people. So that's what we did. And we raised enough money for about 5 adaptive bikes for the therapy program. And it was such a powerful opportunity for me to have this project to focus on, especially for that first year. So as I was going in and out of surgeries, I could, you know, once I was alert and awake again after surgery, I could sit there on my iPad and, you know, look at connecting with sponsors or connecting with media or, you know, whatever it was for this upcoming bike ride.
Let's fast forward, take you, because I really want people to read the book. It's beautifully written, number one. It's just one of those books you truly cannot put down. Now, it may be more of a chick book than a guy book for some people, but I can't imagine anyone not relating to this story who rides a bicycle. Tell us what you're doing now, what you're able to do that you didn't think you'd ever be able to do.
I'm actually sitting at my desk right now, and I have a desk cycle underneath my desk.
Of course you
and
do.
I'm talking to you and biking, which is pretty fun. 90% of what I do, I didn't think I'd be able to do. I just got back from Tampa yesterday. We were down there for a Gasparilla Distance Classic, and I did a book signing for 2 days. I ran 4 events in 2 days, spent time with my nephews, you know, running around the town, and I bike almost daily when I can. You know, I didn't think that I would have the ability to make a positive impact really so much anymore in this life, not just for others, but even for myself, and to bike again on the roads, because I, you know, was, and I still am terrified of biking on the road, but now I am more comfortable advocating and sharing my story with the biking community, which took a while. I speak as a motivational speaker all over the country and different countries. But when it would come down to speaking about encouraging people to ride bikes, it took a couple of years to be able to do that. Because to share my love of cycling with someone else almost made me feel like I'm sharing death with someone else, because I would just immediately equate it to this gift that I've always looked at with such love, to potentially causing someone to die. And now I'm at this point where I can share the gift of cycling again and know that it's not about cycling. It's about reminding the human family that they need to respect each other. And that's a powerful message. And our society is so reactive, we're not proactive. And I feel like if I were to have gone out and tried to be an advocate for cycling safety, which I was before, but I spoke often on deaf ears, now I have people's attention.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right. So, you know, and that's true for not just the motorists, but the cyclists. Because as cyclists, we need to respect the rules of the road. You know, we need to be, if we want to be respected, we have to be respectful. And so it goes both ways. And so the message now, which I didn't think I'd be able to articulate as well as I do now, and as well as that's now part of my life, is sharing this message of the human family and the incredible urgency that we have of looking at each other as brothers and sisters and fellow humans, and you know, remembering to that cyclist is someone's everything. And so that's my passion now, is breaking down those boundaries of what we're different, you know, what makes us different instead of what really binds us.
We're going to wrap our conversation up. I have 3 questions that I always ask my guests. But before that, I want to remind listeners that the book is called Gratitude in Motion. It's a true story of hope, determination, and the everyday heroes around us. And it is a book that, go grab yourself a beer or a glass of wine, sit down. You will be hooked from chapter 1. Right from the foreword. From and I don't know who that guy is.
Bart Yasso.
Well, here's one cool thing. It's not too often that a book is sent to me from a publisher. You've already signed the book, and you sign it, Be Love, The World Needs You, Colleen. And so, you know, I opened it, and my husband looked at me, and he goes, oh, my goodness, she signed that book. And I said, she did indeed. This is a special woman right here. Yeah, I don't know who he is, and that's okay. Bart Yasso, who is that?
He was the CEO of Runner's World. He just retired the beginning of January. But he is an avid cyclist.
Yeah, it's a lovely forward. So, what's your favorite food?
Spicy Mexican food.
But a lot of people say Mexican, but not too many people put double spices in front of it. What kind of music do you like to listen to?
Everything but country.
Ooh, interesting. Well, do not be offended, country western fans. And I already know the answer to the last question, but you have to tell our listeners anyway. Do you have any pets?
Yes, we do. We have three wonderful little furry children. We have a dog named Sneaky Pete, and he's our little rescue from Puerto Rico, and he definitely completed our family. And then we have two yellow English Labradors, Jameis and Coda, which are actually named after the bicycle Jameis Coda, which is, they don't make it like they used to, Jameis bicycles, but Jameis used to make a heavy-duty steel frame bike, and that's the bike that I was run over with. So Jameis Coda and Sneaky Pete.
Well, this has just been such an interesting and delightful conversation. I know that everybody who meets you says you are always gracious and always smiling, and that despite all these adversities, you have come out on the other side just being this unbelievable humanitarian.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with me on the show today, and I hope we get to meet in the near future.
Absolutely.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Colleen Kelly Alexander. Her book, Gratitude in Motion, A True Story of Hope, Determination, and the Everyday Heroes Around Us, is available from the Hatchet Book Group or from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the usual suspect places where you get your books. I'd also like to thank Mark Norstad from Paragon Machine Works for taking so much time out of his busy day to talk with me today. I thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.